77 degrees. It's 1 o'clock.
91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we consider a South Florida figure whose legacy is indelible. George Edgar Merrick was a prime force in the Miami property boom of the 1920s, the creative genius and developer of Coral Gables. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Our guest is Florida historian, preservation expert, and author Arva Moore Parks. She's written a complete biography of George Merrick, who created the legendary Coral Gables phases in a torrent of construction, publicity, and sales in a remarkably short period of years. Arva Moore Parks' book is George Merrick, Son of the South Wind, Visionary Creator of Coral Gables. Stay tuned. Topical Currents up next after NPR and regional news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. More emergency assistance may soon be available to Flint, Michigan, where residents have to avoid their tap water because of the threat of lead contamination. Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta says the state legislature may send Governor Rick Snyder an emergency spending bill this week.
Governor Snyder has asked state lawmakers to adopt a $28 million crisis appropriation. That money would be used to provide more water filters and testing kits and stepped-up monitoring of kids who are exposed to lead. Drinking water in some homes and schools became contaminated due to steps taken while Flint was being run by state-appointed managers. State Senator Jim Ananick is from Flint.
This was obviously a man-made failure, a state government failing. We're going to have to take a number of steps before this problem is solved.
Ananick also says the state needs to make a long-term commitment to address the neurological issues and learning disabilities that can be caused by lead exposure. For NPR News, I'm Rick Pluta in Lansing, Michigan.
Neighborhoods across the Washington, D.C. area are running out of room to put all the snow that fell during one of the region's worst blizzards. More than 2 feet are piled high along major arteries and residential roads, forcing many pedestrians to share a lane with passing cars because the sidewalks are buried. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says that cannot happen tomorrow.
As our kids go back to school tomorrow, it is imperative that all residential sidewalks are clear.
Local governments are attempting to get a handle on the economic impact from that snowstorm. Economists Ryan Sweet of Moody's Analytics says restaurants were among the hardest hit.
If you're going to go out and eat out last weekend, but you didn't, you're not going to go out and eat out twice next weekend to make up for that loss. So those lost sales are permanent.
He estimates overall loss was relatively tame, as he put it, at $2.5 billion to $3 billion. The Navy Medical Center San Diego is on lockdown this hour. Officials are investigating reports of gunshots heard on the compound. Federal health officials have updated recommendations for screening adults for depression. NPR's Patty Naiman reports that for the first time, the recommendations specifically include pregnant women and women who have recently given birth.
The recommendations made by a special task force of independent experts say all adults should be screened for depression in primary care settings where treatment options are available. Treatment includes psychotherapy, antidepressants, or a combination of both. Once diagnosed and treated, depressive symptoms can be significantly reduced. Previous research has raised concern that certain antidepressants can cause birth defects. The recommendations say the risk is low, but that doctors should consider interventions like counseling for pregnant and breastfeeding women. The recommendations are published in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
The Dow is up 285 points, or 1.7%, at 16,170. This is NPR.
From the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald, I'm Christine DiMattei. The U.S. Coast Guard is investigating what caused the sinking of a yacht last night off the coast of Lauderdale-by-the-Sea with 13 people aboard. The Coast Guard safely rescued everyone on board the 106-foot yacht shortly after a distress call was placed. No one was injured. According to the Sun Sentinel, the ship had departed Port Everglades on its way to the Bahamas. Memorial services have been arranged for Friday for Nabil El-Sanadi, the president and CEO of Broward Health. According to police, El-Sanadi died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound on Saturday at his Broward County condo. He was 60 years old. A Florida Keys man has been ruled competent to stand trial in an alleged plot the FBI says was inspired by the Islamic State terror group to detonate a bomb on a beach in the Keys. A defense attorney and a federal prosecutor said in a joint court filing late yesterday that 23-year-old Harlem Suarez is mentally fit to stand trial. Well, it's the second day of the third week of Florida's regular legislative session, and a new study from the Pew Charitable Trust suggests that Florida lawmakers are in the middle of some of the biggest policy challenges facing the state. The State of the State series examines policy trends around issues like education funding, Medicaid expansion, state budgets, and criminal justice. Scott Greenberger is the executive editor on the project.
Florida is a very big and diverse state, and politically it's somewhat purple, so people are always going to pay a lot of attention to what's going on there. Governor Scott has been very vocal in promoting performance-based funding for public universities and colleges, and that's something that is becoming increasingly popular across the country. Something like half the states now base at least some of their public higher ed funding on outcomes.
Greenberger says the release of the report comes at the beginning of legislative sessions across the country, and he hopes it's a way for lawmakers in different capitals to connect the dots and learn from one another. This is WLRN Miami Herald News. I'm Christine DeMattei. And now here's Paul Leary.
Okay, Chris, thank you so much for that report. Stay with us for Topical Currents. It's coming right up.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Constant Contact, with live coaching, email marketing features such as drag-and-drop editing, and social media tools. Constant Contact is committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits become marketers. More at ConstantContact.com.
And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. One of the titans of South Florida's development is George E. Merrick, a figure forever known as the visionary planner and developer of Coral Gables.
The Gables, the city beautiful, delightful homes, tree canopies, the Biltmore, the Venetian pool, library, and the Congregational Church.
Of course, prime dining spots, Miracle Mile, the University of Miami, the Coral Gables Museum, and much more. Our guest is noted Florida historian, author, and preservationist, and longtime resident of South Florida, Arva Moore Parks. She's written the definitive biography of its visionary planner and developer, George Edgar Merrick.
The book is George Merrick, Son of the South Wind, Visionary Creator of Coral Gables, and we welcome Arva Moore Parks.
Thank you. Love being here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. What an accomplishment. How important was writing this book to you?
It was very important because I had lived in the Gables and I had worked in preservation in the Gables, but Mildred Merrick, his sister-in-law, had shared a bunch of documents no one had ever seen, including me, and that was what prompted the whole thing.
And how long did it take you to write this?
Seemed like every time I saw you over the past decade, you were working on the book.
Well, I probably spent more than 10 years, but I did other things in between. But the other thing that happened is my best friend Adele Graham's daughter married David McCullough, the famous biographer, historian. And so I got to know him and told him, I'm thinking about writing this. Give me some advice. And he said, you have to get him behind your eyes. You have to travel to all the places he and his family lived, so you can understand the man. So that's what I did. So in that period, I traveled to every single place where the Merrick family and the Fink family, particularly his mother's family, lived and where they lived when he was young. And that was, I always said, research is fun and writing is work. So between all the new material and the travels to get him behind my eyes, that took a while.
And you had the prologue that you were going to read from. Would you like to do that now?
The Prologue Society?
We are not getting to that yet. The prologue from the book.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yes, when I finished all of this, I tried to figure out, okay, I had him behind my eyes. What was my goal? And there was a description of him written in 1925, which was the very height of his glory, shall we say. And I think it really sums up what I was hoping to do. What manner of man is this George E. Merrick? Dreamer, yes, and more, a dreamer with the faculty for surrounding himself with men to translate his dreams into practicality, into buildings and lakes and waterways and beautiful landscapes, into flowers and shrubs and homes, and into churches and schools and institutions of higher learning, and beaches and playgrounds and cities. Writer, poet, dreamer, philosopher, lover of all things beautiful, creator, thinker, kindly, courteous, good-natured, gregarious human man. All of these can be applied to George Merrick. And after I finished, I would say, absolutely, this is a very good description. And all of these things can be applied to George Merrick.
Well, I'd like you to take us, you know, just a little bit back in his life. And, you know, South Florida was a pretty wild place when his family came here from Duxbury, Massachusetts. So could you just tell us a little about his family, why they came here, and who they were?
Well, what's amazing about his family is both his mother and his father were college graduates. And his father's had a master's from Yale in divinity. His father was a congregational minister. And his mother was an artist. She's the Fink family. That's the most influential on him. And they had lived in Gaines, New York, where his father's had his first church. And I went there and found incredible information there. And then he was really a big promotion to Duxbury, which is the pilgrim church. It's the, you know, the birthplace of all the good pilgrims and the Congregationalists. And they were there, and there was a terrible freeze there. I'm thinking about now. This freeze was called the storm of the century, just like they're talking about right now. And one of his children died of diphtheria, and they were devastated, needless to say. And Grandpa Fink, who was the Method circuit riding minister who became very wealthy manufacturing Fink's magic oil, came to the funeral, and he had sent his salesman to this brand new town of Miami and told him about it, where the sun always shone. And so Solomon Merrick wrote Bolton, who was the minister of what became Plymouth Church, and Bolton said, there's this homestead for sale in the back country of Coconut Grove. And that was the first 160 acres where the Merrick House is today.
And they bought that sight unseen.
Sight unseen for $1,200. And Althea and the children went to Springdale, where her father lived, Pennsylvania. And George and his father came to Miami. And when they got here, Bolton picked them up. They actually, when they got here, there was a yellow fever epidemic, and they couldn't go in. Can you imagine what Solomon Merrick thinking about that, leaving terrible
there for his...
But Bolton took him out in a mule cart, and when Solomon Merrick called what they called the shack, which was the homestead house, he said, how am I going to tell my wife what I did? But George, the optimist, he was like the Fink family, and so was Althea, and said, no, we're gonna stay here. He was only 13, and when they lived in Duxbury, he went to a fancy school and was on his way to Harvard. He was a brilliant student. And when he got to Miami at 13, he never went to school again until he went to Rollins College.
I guess it could be said that eventually Coral Gables had its beginnings in grapefruit and guava. Tell us about George.
Absolutely. The crop that the homesteader named Gregory had used, you have to get a homestead. This is free land from the federal government. You had to have a crop. His crop was guavas. And they also had vegetables in what is now the Granada Golf Course. But Solomon Merrick had the idea of planting grapefruit, which was kind of an exotic fruit in that era. And he planted grapefruit, but that took a while to, you know, to grow. So in the meantime, they sold guavas and vegetables. And George rolled the mule cart into Miami every day and sold vegetables to the Royal Palm Hotel. It's like 14.
I love that picture out in front of, I believe, their house of Coral Gables being a thin little gravel pathway.
That was it. That was Coral Way.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, no, it was very primitive. And the thing that's very interesting about George, too, is he was a very liberal person when it came to races, because his friends were all the young black teenage boys from Coconut Grove, Bahamians.
The Bahamians.
Those were his friends. If you live 160 acres away from your next neighbor and you don't go to school, and you're 13. Right. You don't have a lot of buddies, except for these Black Bahamians. And he stayed close to them the rest of his life.
And it was called the Coral Gables Plantation?
It was called the Coral Gables Plantation.
The business, the citrus.
Yeah, but the grapefruit.
Grapefruit.
And George wanted to be a writer, and he finally, when the groves began to bear, as his father used to say, one of George Pullman says, when the groves begin to bear, he was allowed to go to college. Of course, he hadn't gone to school since he was 13, but Rollins is a congregational church college, and they let him in a secretarial course. So he took shorthand and typing, but he was very brilliant, and he got in the regular school and won the oratory prize, the only freshman in history. So then his father decided he should go to law school. So he sent him off to New York Law School. George wanted to be a writer. He did not want to be a lawyer or anything else. And he had a short story selected by the New York Herald Tribune, won the first prize. And this is 1910 now. He wrote his father and said, I want to drop out of law school. But his father had a bad heart, like most of the Merrick men. And George, as the oldest dutiful son, had to come home. So he came home.
And what year was this?
1910. He came home to help his father run the groves. And within 6 months, his father was dead. So George took over the groves. And he's the one that really made the grapefruit extremely wealthy. And I remember Eunice Merrick, his widow that I did know, told me one time, George was a millionaire before he ever started Coral Gables. And he became rich on grapefruit.
Amazing.
He sent the first carload of grapefruit out of South Florida.
Well, he had some practice in developing before starting Coral Gables. The 12th Street Manors was the last. But to kind of take us from the point of being a farmer into being on the verge of developing Coral Gables.
Well, he had this idea of doing this perfect suburb, but he didn't know how to develop. He only knew how to grow grapefruit and write poetry. So he got a job as a developer and began to do suburbs around Miami. And he worked for a company eventually called Realty Securities Company. And he worked for them for a while, and they were major. They did Woodlawn Park, too, the cemetery, and that's where George is buried. And he was involved in creating Woodlawn Park. You know how beautiful Woodlawn Park is. And then he left Realty Securities, and the last one he did was 12th Street Manors. And people knew he was gonna do Coral Gables, but he wasn't going to touch it until he knew what to do.
This was right after the World War?
Yes, this gets in during the war, and they slowed down during the war.
And he was a millionaire at that time.
Yes, he was a millionaire.
Which in today's dollars would be, my God.
Wow, yeah.
Times 20.
Yeah.
So he didn't want to do Coral Gables until he knew what he wanted to do. And so to plan Coral Gables, he looked all over at what he loved, like Mediterranean and Spanish architecture. What else did he do?
Well, he traveled to Shaker Heights, which he considered a really wonderful. He traveled to Roland Heights, which is near where his grandfather lived. And he was really, he didn't want Coral Gables to be a city. He wanted to be Miami's master suburb. He went to St. Augustine where he went to Cuba. He never went to Europe. And he read Washington Irving's Alhambra. And that's where Eunice Merrick, his widow, told me that they opened the book in the first section of Coral Gables. They named all the streets after the streets in southern Spain and Washington Irving's Alhambra. So I, of course, got the book, opened it up, and she was
there
absolutely correct, except for Sorolla, who was an artist. So the first section. So it's Florida history. You know, he loved history. But he was a philosopher. He read Ruskin and Morris and all the English philosophers. And he did Coral Gables originally for the middle class. And it was to be all coral rock because he believed, like Ruskin, that the middle class deserved beauty just like the rich. And it was just so successful that he expanded his vision, is what I call that chapter.
Mm. We're speaking with Arva Moore Parks, a noted author, historian, and preservationist, about her book, George Merrick, Son of the South Wind. A short break on today's Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
The David Lawrence Jr. Champion for Children Award is presented each year by the Children's Trust. This honor is bestowed on an individual for trailblazing work with lasting impact or for achieving positive systemic change for children and families in Miami-Dade. Previous honorees include Sister Lucia Cicotti, retired juvenile court judge William Gladstone, immigrant rights advocate Cheryl Little, and autism expert Dr. Michael Alessandri. Nominations are accepted through February 11th. Details at thechildrenstrust.org.
Preventive medicine is important. By having an annual checkup, your primary care physician can treat a disease as early as possible or prevent it in the first place. Baptist Health Primary Care is redefining the patient experience with same-day or next-day appointments, extended weekday and weekend hours, plus a medical care team dedicated to you. Baptist Health Primary Care, where caring comes first. More information is available at primarycareredefined.com.
We're funded by WLRN members and by Sky Zone Trampoline Parks of Miami, committed to offering healthy, active fun for the whole family, as well as venues for hosting birthday parties, group outings, and corporate events. Information at skyzone.com/Miami.
Is listening to WLRN worth $4 a day? If so, please consider becoming a member of the Circle of Friends. When you give a contribution of $1,200 or more, your gift will provide long-term stability for WLRN. Information at WLRN.org.
George Merrick, son of the South Wind, visionary creator of Coral Gables. We're speaking with the book's author, Arva Moore Parks, longtime historian, preservationist, and author. And of course, we're talking about that marvelous book about George Merrick. Arva, 1921, the pace that you remember of George Merrick building Coral Gables is just incredible. The openings and the hordes of workers and just getting material to the job sites was just amazing.
Yes, the first lots were November 21, and he did all the entrances and plazas. And the thing people need to also realize, there was no Coral Gables Corporation. It was the George Merrick Company. He owned it all. He put all his own money into building the roads and building the entrances and plazas and all the beautiful things we think of, fountains and Coral Gables, Venetian pool. And people don't realize that today. They get a lot of information, talk about the Coral Gables Corporation. That didn't come until 25.
Arva, did he have adversaries or people who were not so enthralled with his vision of what Coral Gables should be?
Yeah, there were people that said nobody would allow architectural controls, that nobody would buy. He proved them wrong. He sold like crazy. He had 5,000 people there for the first day of sales. Mm. And so it sold like crazy. And people loved the rock and they loved they loved all of it. So from the very beginning, he succeeded.
What about the parallels and possible competition with the Shoreland Corporation, which, of course, was developer of Miami Shores and some of the islands in Biscayne Bay?
That came, the Miami Shores as a community was really a little bit later than George Merrick 21, you're talking a little bit later. And often people think he copied Meisner. Meisner's parallel to Addison Coral Gables is Addison Meisner in Palm Beach. Meisner's parallel is Boca Raton. That wasn't announced until 24. And he really copied Coral Gables as a planned community. He was building mansions for millionaires, which was the exact opposite of what George wanted. But he did like the Spanish style in the beginning. It was a Spanish city in Florida, or Spanish community. But then it became, because of his cousin, George Fink, it evolved into what should be called Mediterranean style, which was an invented style by George Fink, gave it the name. That's his first cousin, who was one of the, what I call the Big Four, that was an architect involved in the creation of Coral Gables.
I didn't realize, I guess I should have realized, that City Beautiful was a movement, an architecture and design movement that existed, and that's where the name the City Beautiful comes from, as the nickname for Coral Gables, but I was unaware of the whole design movement that he used.
George never used that term.
Oh, he didn't.
Ever. But Frank Button had worked in the Columbian Exposition, where the City Beautiful movement we talk about as being born. So some of the plazas and the circles, the City Beautiful movement had some influence. But he was much more influenced by the Garden City movement, which was, again, middle-class beauty. So the city beautiful is the term today they use, but it was never used by George.
Well, talk more about the Finks, because you say they were nearly forgotten. And
the Finks were unbelievable. His grandfather Fink is the man over the fireplace, because a lot of people have been in the Merrick House. He was this Methodist circuit riding, charismatic, hellfire damnation preacher in southeastern Ohio. And I traveled his circuit and got the feeling, read the newspapers, and he was the one that the family said George was the most like, both in his marketing skills and his charisma. And after the Civil War, he began manufacturing Fink's Magic Oil and became very wealthy.
And what was that?
It was something that cured everything. I bought a bottle on eBay, and it cured everything, cancer, you name it. And it was about 80% alcohol in a little bottle.
No wonder.
And the Methodists were teetotalers, so I could just see the Methodists enjoying their Fink Magic Oil to cure everything.
Talk about some of the great events that were held in Coral Gables for the openings of new plats and new buildings, all the wonderful things that we know Coral Gables about now. It was such a social center.
Well, and George was a marketing whiz. I said he was like his grandfather. So he knew how to have special openings. He would get everybody together. He'd bring in the downtown people to come out for the openings. That was somewhat later, like the Biltmore, for instance. He was very much with Bowman. He was
Isn't
a partner.
There a wing walker or something involved?
Oh, yeah. That was early now. He had airplanes landing on the Granada golf course. That was his first, quote, airport. And he brought in a very famous woman aviatrix. And people came out to see that. Thousands of people came out. And, of course, he would sell them a little real estate on the side. And the Coral Gables Country Club was really the first sales center. And he would take them up in the tower and show them all the grapefruit groves. And now you can have a lot here, you can have a lot there. So he was a marketing genius, no question.
What about, talk about the Biltmore and just tell us about the Biltmore.
Well, the Biltmore, he had this idea to build this luxury hotel. And the first, Martin Hampton was the first architect, but then Bowman of the Biltmore chain got in. He got him interested in it. And so that's when they switched to Schultz and Weaver, and that's when the hotel. He was actually Bowman's partner, so he was a 50% owner. Mm. And he had a wonderful, the Tower Suite is actually where he had his, George had his office. And when he spoke at the opening of the Biltmore, which was in 26, he said, January 26th, he said, this is the most important thing I've ever done. But a month later, he spoke at the groundbreaking of the University of Miami, and he said, this is the most important thing I've ever done. Nothing compares to that.
Arva, could you touch a little bit on Eunice Merrick, his wife? They were childless, and his marriage's ups and downs.
Eunice Merrick was a beautiful woman. And she was a peacock of the Peacock Inn in Coconut Grove. And she became very close to Flora McFarlane, who was a teacher. And Flora wanted her to go off to finish in school in New Jersey. So she sent her off, and Eunice got pretty sophisticated. And when she came back, she was the hottest ticket. She was beautiful, and all the guys were after
her. She really was.
And George was very handsome, and all the women were after him. And I think, and I'm sure of this, that she's the only woman in town that gave him a hard time, which, of course, made her all the more desirable. He finally succeeded in getting her to marry him.
Handsome and a millionaire.
And they got married in 1916.
Well, her family too had.
Well, they had lost a lot of it. So, but she got very wealthy instantly. Yes, but she could have married half the town, and so could he. So they were a really what we would call today, I guess, a beautiful couple. They were a beautiful couple.
So but, the main part of Coral Gables really was established within about a period of 4 years, which is pretty astounding. And now we're starting to approach the end of the boom. This has been the tremendous boom of real estate in South Florida. the most in history, probably, the United States. Give people a feel for what it was like downtown and the Binder Boys. Yeah, and
I think he helped create the Boob because he had ads all over America. He actually had a Coral Gables office off of Times Square. He had one in Pittsburgh and Detroit and Chicago. And so he helped get people down here for the Boom. And then, like you were saying, it spread all over South Florida, and there were people selling binders or like a down payment on a lot. Those were called the Binder Boys. They never worked in Coral Gables. They didn't need to. He was selling himself. But the people talk the Boom ended with the hurricane of September 1926. It didn't end for George. He lost most of his fortune, which was worth more than $1 billion, between 26 and 28. That's when he built most of the villages.
That was before the Depression.
He poured all his money trying to keep Coral Gables. He was going to, quote, finish Coral Gables. Mm. That's when he did most of the villages in Coral Gables were done in that era. He poured money into it. And in 1928, when he was thrown out, actually, he didn't have any money at all.
Now, he was thrown off the city commission of the city that he had built and founded.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well, he didn't want it to be a city, and as late as November of 24, he was still writing full-page ads, but there was a movement, and he realized it was going to happen. So when the city was created, he created the Coral Gables Corporation a month before the city, and all his corporate people who had worked for him became the first commission. I mean, you can imagine today that would never have been allowed to happen. And then when the Depression began hitting, the people in Coral Gables, a lot of the people, the dissidents, I call them, had a recall election and threw everybody off the commission except George. And then George and this group of anti-Coral Gables people were on the commission. And in 1928, they arranged for him to be thrown off. So he was thrown out, literally thrown out of Coral Gables in 1928. So he had 7 years to stamp it with what we still see today.
Where did he go when he was thrown off the commission?
Well, he hoped to finish, and he became good friends with a man named Doherty, who was city service. And Doherty he hoped was going to help him finish. Meanwhile, he did get Doherty to buy University of Miami out of bankruptcy. So Doherty did save the university.
You haven't even mentioned the university yet.
Or Fairchild.
Yeah, but then Doherty died, and then that ended George's hope for Coral Gables. Mm. So he had started his own little real estate firm and didn't do well at all. And then in 1940, he took the postmaster exam and had the highest score.
He didn't view it as a come down, though.
No, he viewed it as a way to pay his debts. The Coral Gables Corporation declared bankruptcy, but he never declared personal bankruptcy. And he was still paying off his debt. He's paying off his mother's funeral expenses, $15 a month. Think of that. A man who was a billionaire.
We're speaking about George Merrick, son of the South Wind, with the author of the book by that name, Florida historian, author, preservationist, longtime resident, and native, Arva Moore Parks. A short break. We'll be right back.
On January 27th, the Broward Center for the Performing Arts presents composer-pianist Pablo Ziegler and violinist Lara St. John performing works from tango maestro Astor Piazzolla's famous 1987 Central Park Concert. The powerful program includes such beloved pieces as La Camorra, Verano Porteño, and Concierto para Quinteto, as well as exquisite originals by Ziegler. Tickets available at browardcenter.org and Ticketmaster.
You can experience the glamour of Italy's La Dolce Vita at NSU Art Museum Fort Lauderdale's Bellissima, Italy and High Fashion, 1945 to 1968. You can explore the remarkable era of creativity and fashion history that led to Italy's resurgence after World War II in this exhibition featuring over 200 Italian designer garments, accessories, jewels, art, and film on view February 7th to June 5th. Details at nsuartmuseum.org or 954-525-5500.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Air Como. Does your business use compressed air or vacuum? Air Como's professionals have been servicing the compressed air and vacuum requirements of businesses in South Florida for over 15 years. More information at aircomo.com.
My Son the Waiter, a Jewish Tragedy, starring Brad Zimmerman, is described as an hilarious and inspiring comedy about the grit and passion needed to make it as an artist. The New York Times called My Son the Waiter delicious, a great comedy. Tickets at mysonthewaiter.com.
Did you know? Do you know the song, Irvin?
Yeah.
Of course.
I told him about it.
Ah!
I hope you know Charleston a little bit.
And that is the Golden Gate Orchestra, which is a pseudonym for the California Ramblers, singing When the Moon Shines in Coral Gables. Then it says vocal chorus by Charles Hart. Do we know who's that?
George Merrick didn't miss any opportunity to market Coral Gables. He's the one that got this song going. It was a nationally important song. And it's kind of hokey, but at the time, you know, you could see people dancing away and having a lovely time. Charleston and, you know, two-step.
I put that in the system, and I had an earworm for about 24 hours after I did. It was a very catchy tune.
But it's very much part of the story.
There's a flapper dress down in the Coral Gables Museum there.
That was Eunice's dress. She had beautiful, beautiful clothes, and they were all flapper clothes. You know, that was the 20s, and they were beautiful. She had beautiful, you know, designer clothes.
Arvo, I'd like to just, before we go on with George Merrick and his fate and Coral Gables, you're of that rare breed, a native Miamian. So tell us about your early years and your journey and how you became an historian and preservationist.
Well, I lived in, when I was born, I lived in what was then Riverside, now Little Havana, and I lived there until I was 9. And my father was a lawyer, and he loved history, and he read history. He always was reading history books. And he used to take me around Miami and say, remember this, remember this. So I'd laugh and say, I just did what I was told. I'm very visual, and I do have my own memory of Miami. But when I went to college, I was going to be a history teacher, so I was a history major. And I was teaching at my alma mater, Miami Edison, and there was a sign on the board for a graduate course. You had to apply, and I did, and I got accepted. And I met Dr. Charlton Tebow, who was the major Florida historian. And he was getting ready to retire, and he was looking for someone to replace him. So I walked in the door, and the rest is kind of history. He was my mentor. My original thesis was on Coconut Grove. And that got me into preservation. And of course, I met Eunice Merrick, then. But we talked more about the peacocks in Coconut Grove.
Well,
I did know her.
Tell us about your Manhattans with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas at her home.
Well, I also, of course, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas was part of Coconut Grove so much. And so I went to her house, and she loved Manhattans. And I went in the evening because I still had young children, and it was hard to go in the daytime. And she was in her nightgown. And
that must have been
it was a 1940s overcoat. It was a cold night. She had her hair in pigtails. And we drank Manhattans. And that's when I met Marjorie, and I knew she was a very amazing woman. And she loved Coconut Grove, and she knew it. She taught me a lot.
Now, did she know George Merrick? Did they know one another?
She actually worked for George Merrick. There's one of his many booklets. He produced probably 20 different kind of pamphlets on Coral Gables. One of them she wrote, and it's really well done. And she just raves and raves about him. It's, again, kind of like what I read by Vernon Knowles and about what he was doing. She knew him very well. They were friends. So I learned about him from her, too.
Tell us more about the development now of Coral Gables post-George Merrick. Of course, people will associate Miracle Mile with Coral Gables all the time, but that was nothing to do with George Merrick.
That had nothing to do with George Merrick. That was post-World War II. And the Coral Gables had been kind of still vacant It was after World War II that the Veterans Administration, some of the people came in and were building a lot of the houses, that are the 50s houses, the 40s houses. Miracle Mile started then. The George Merrick had been kind of lost in time in that era. It's amazing to me. When I moved in the Gables in 1970, he was kind of around, but the city had turned down the Merrick House for purchase about four times. There weren't three votes to save the Biltmore. I love to tell those stories. People just can't believe it today. But we were able, they had the first preservation board, thanks to a wonderful man named Don LeBrun. And I was the first chair, really. And that's when I began to pull all of this together, and I reconnected with Eunice Merrick. And then I got to know Richard Merrick, George's youngest brother, who is probably the closest to George Merrick I've ever been, because everybody said he was a lot like George. He was also an intellectual. He was an artist. And he's the one that Eunice Merrick left all these papers to me that made it possible for me to do this book.
And you said he was actually forgotten for years, George Merrick? That's so hard to believe.
Even at UM, there had been a thing, there was a man that said he did it, not George, and I proved otherwise on that one, too, later.
You don't want to say who?
Well, he was a judge, I'd rather not.
Okay.
But he gets credit. He was in on it. But the reason University of Miami started is because George Merrick gave him 160 acres and $5 million, okay? You could dream and talk about it, but George did it. George made it happen, and he gets credit. He should get credit, and he does get credit now.
And what about Fairchild? That was also important to him.
I think when I've talked to national planners and everyone, one of the unique things about Coral Gables is the landscaping. He planted 30,000 trees in that eight-year period, and he grew them all, and he paid for them all, and he loved the garden. He loved Gifford even more than Fairchild. He was very close to John Gifford, the other big naturalist. But when Fairchild Tropical Garden started, he was very close. This is after he lost everything. He spoke at the opening in 1938. And for the rest of his life, the two places he kept trying to raise money for and to help were UM and Fairchild Tropical Garden.
Everything with George had to be the biggest and the greatest, including the Venetian pool. Tell us how that came about.
Oh, that is unique in the world, you know, and everybody tells me that too. When he was building everything out of coral rock, that was his rock pit. Those of us that grew up here, always called them rock pits, and Miami Lakes was full of rock pits, and there were rock pits all over the place. And that's where they ended up being these, quote, lakes in the middle. But it was an unsightly thing in his Coral Gables. And Denman Fink, his uncle, the artist, the other most important, his mother's brother, the other most important person in the vision, came up with the idea of making it a pool. And the Denman Fink's drawings on the cover of the book. And he was not an architect, he was an artist. And George Fink took the drawing and turned it into architectural plans. And when you look at the drawing, and you look at Venetian Pool today, you say, oh my goodness, it's pure art. And it opened, and it's the city owns it. It's unique. It's on the National Register and all those good things. I learned to swim there. My children learned to swim there. Kids are still learning to swim there. It's a municipal pool.
What about, you were saying George Fink's studio now has been, Coral Gables has purchased it?
That's the best news of the last week. George Fink, who was the forgotten man, his granddaughter, Lainey Fink Schumacher, when this all began, walked into my office with three scrapbooks. And that's when I realized the importance of George Fink. You think George Merrick had been forgotten. George Fink had come in completely forgotten. And I was able to resurrect him. He named Mediterranean style. He created it. And he built that studio. It was a lot of us that grew up here, it was Dr. Kitchen's office, so people would know what I'm talking about. And he said, that's the example of the Mediterranean style. And the city just bought it. And as I told him, if I could do backflips, I would have. It is very much intact in the interior. And I'm going over there tomorrow because some of the furnishings, I think, are still original. And the city is going to get those, too. And I believe they're going to make it a place to explain Coral Gables' unique Mediterranean style.
Some people may have experienced Coral Gables at Doc Dammer's Saloon, and we haven't touched on Doc Dammer's and the selling of Coral Gables.
Well, I actually came up with that idea. I worked for the people who built the Colonnade. And
That was your idea to name it Doc Dammer Saloon?
And I went around with, I did all those pictures and went around and had people sign it to put on the wall. And Doc Dammer's was a master salesman. And George hired him to sell the first lots in 1921. And he was very close to George, and he adored George. And even when George was losing everything, Doc Dammer's never turned his back. And he was the first mayor. And he lived on Coral Way in a big house. And like George, he did like to, this was Prohibition, and they all had their little wine cellars, they called them. And so Doc Dammer's was known to do a little tippling with George in that era.
So the saloon was aptly named then.
And it was perfect to name the saloon after him. But he was a character, you see, in that saloon. It worked out great for him to be a character. And people said Doc Dammer's could sell you anything. You know, he was a master salesman, like George.
We're speaking with Arva Moore Parks, a noted historian, author, preservationist, and longtime resident of South Florida and a native. And she's written the book, George Merrick, Son of the South Wind, Visionary Creator of Coral Gables. Our last break, and we'll be right back.
Broward College presents Chanticleer, an orchestra of voices, Thursday, January 28th, in the newly renovated Bailey Hall. For more information, visit baileyhall.org.
If writing a book or movie is your dream, creative writing workshops return to Miami Book Fair year-round, February 23rd at Miami-Dade College. Workshops in screenwriting, historical fiction, and publishing. Details at thecenter@mdc.org.
We're funded by WLRN members and by Nada's Italy, tours for people who don't go on tours. You can explore Italy at a leisurely pace in a small group setting, connect with locals, and experience authentic cuisine, art, and culture. More at nadasitaly.com.
Our Florida Reefs is a community-based planning process for the future of Southeast Florida's coral reefs. Community representatives have drafted recommended management actions to better balance the use and protection of this valuable resource. Our Florida Reefs invite you to learn about and add your voice to the conversation by attending one of their upcoming community meetings in January and February of 2016. For a complete list of dates and locations, please visit ourfloridareefs.org.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. We continue our conversation with Arva Moore Parks. She's written George Merrick, Son of the South Wind. If you want to speak to Arva, just to give her kudos or congratulate her, or if you have a question about George Merrick, we have a little time left. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org.
Arva, tell us a little more about how the Coral Gables Museum came about. You were its first curator and instrumental in its formation, and I think its first president, and are still tremendously involved with it.
Well, the real godfather of the museum is Chip Withers, who was on the commission, and he had the idea of doing this museum in Coral Gables, and it was in the old police and fire station, which was a WPA project. And so we got it open, and it's a place where you can tell the story. And so we hope that people will go there and appreciate this man who's interpreted in there in the permanent exhibit. This is where you can get the feeling of Coral Gables and to truly understand it and stand up for it.
Let's take a telephone call. First up, we have Clay in Miami. Hi.
Hello. I called because I used to represent Eunice Merrick late in her life, and she was just such a wonderful, sweet lady, still beautiful even in her later years, and always full of stories about, rollerblading around what's now Coconut Grove, and my only regret from those years is that I didn't take a tape recorder with me every time I met with her.
She wouldn't have let you tape record her.
Probably not.
She didn't like that, but she was amazing, and that's wonderful to hear. You're just describing the woman, I would say, the same way you did. She was an amazingly beautiful woman in her 90s.
And just as sweet as pie. I mean, you know, even as she, you know, even as her health got worse, she would still just be thrilled to see you when you showed up at the door. She was gracious enough, because George was one of the charter members of the Orange Bowl Committee. Of course, they offered him seats every year, and she gave me the opportunity to buy George Merrick seats for years and years. So I had very good Orange Bowl seats for a long time.
I guess so. Well, thank you, Clay. Thanks so much for calling.
Sure thing.
Arva, I put two words together. Arva, tell us about the movement now to keep the architecture in Coral Gables. Is there some resistance there? What's going on?
Yeah, I worry as we speak that there's a lot of people that don't understand how important it is to keep the ideals, as George called them, in Coral Gables. It's the first preservation board, but it also has had a zoning code since before there was a city. George had its zoning requirements before the city was created, and an architectural board. It still has an architectural board. But the zoning code says that you have to keep neighborhood context. And we've had a run on very modern architecture being accepted in the middle of some of the historic streets. And I find that very troubling. Also, the high rises, you know, George actually was not opposed to high rises. They just have to be in the right place. He did have some plans for building high rises down in what is now Coca Plum.
How high are you talking about, though?
High.
High?
Like
okay.
The Biltmore.
Okay.
Another right. Biltmore down there is what he had in mind. But we got the Mediterranean architecture ordinance in. I worked on that because we were getting those glass boxes with flat roofs. And so we got it where if you did Mediterranean style, you would get a bonus of a couple floor. We got the towers back. And if you notice if you look at the skyline of Coral Gables, you will see, George said it had to go like this against the cloud mountains. So I think we're one more turning point right now, and I hope that the architectural board will realize the importance of keeping context via the zoning code and not let modern intrusion into a street that does have the similar ambiance.
Is there anything that residents of Coral Gables could be doing?
Yes, we have some who are standing up one more time. That's the other strength of Coral Gables. Residents pay attention. And you can fill the chamber easily if there's something that they perceive is against the best for Coral Gables, and that's a plus.
If someone wanted to get the best idea of George Merrick's vision of Coral Gables, are there a couple of streets that someone should drive down if they were maybe from out of the area, just to kind of get a feel of the original?
Well, Coral Way. Yeah. Coral Way, even on Coral Way, though, there's
the trolleys. We didn't mention the trolleys.
Oh, yeah, no, he had the first trolleys out here, too. But Coral Way, and you have the Merrick House, but you have a bunch of rock houses. Coral Gables has a thematic rock historic house thing now, so they've all been somewhat protected. But even on Coral Way, there's been a new modern house, and I don't know how that happened. And I almost wrecked my car when I saw it. But it really, again, there are places in South Gables that he never really got to do where modern houses would be wonderful, but not in the midst of all of his Coral Gables, which was primarily north of Bird Road.
So how do you think he would, if he could take a peek at Coral Gables today, would he be pleased?
I don't like to say what I think he would think.
Okay.
But I can say what he had planned. And a lot of the things, the business district, some of the things he had planned, see, have happened.
Okay.
So sometimes some people say, oh, they're going to build this high rise. We got to stop it. And it'll be in an area where he actually had planned a high rise.
Well, you're the person to ask.
And we'll continue on with Peter in Miami. Hi.
Yes. Hello, this is Peter Ehrlich. I'm calling a brief call, a compliment. Arva, for doing such a wonderful job.
Thanks, Peter.
And also, thank you very much for helping to show respect for the historic names and neighborhoods like Lemon City and Little River, many of the others that are fighting to stay to stay on people's conscience.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, Peter.
Bye.
And we'll move along to another caller, Sam. Sam's in Kendall. Hi.
Hi. How are you all this afternoon?
Good.
She referred to George's connection, or to his Bahamian friends from Coconut Grove, I assume black Bahamian friends from Coconut Grove when he was younger. Did his relationship continue with the Bahamian community as he began to develop the Gables in the 20s, i.e. with the the Prohibition and rum runners that were bringing stuff in from the Bahamas, which was going through its own expansion and expansion program at the time because of Prohibition and lots of money flowing there. Did they have anything to do with financing or assisting him in the development of the Gables?
They worked with George on building Coral Gables as a subdivision. The same teenage boys became young men and the workers. He also said that we should have listened to them, though, and that's really important. He called them the Wayshowers. He said, we shouldn't have listened to the Crackers and the Yankees. We should listen to those that knew how to live and love the tropics. And everything was segregated by law, so he couldn't build a neighborhood. He couldn't integrate. But he built the McFarland Homestead for the black community before he did Coral Gables. And that's a very important, because the people in Coconut Grove would not let the black Bahamians spread out. So he built the McFarland Homestead for them. Then it became part of Coral Gables. And recently I was able to clear that up. Some people said, oh, he was a segregationist. You know, he did it before Coral Gables and then brought it in, and it was segregated by law. But he was very close, and they wrote about him and they loved him.
We don't have much time left, Arva, but you are the founding chair of the Prologue Society. And actually, it was the Prologue Society who let us know that you were writing this book and presenting it there. So what is the Prologue Society? Tell us about that.
This is a group of history book readers and lovers. And Ray Marchman from Northern Trust in 92 came to me. He had started the Literary Society at Northern Trust, which was the literature. And he wanted to do a history one. So he started it. I came up with the name because on the National Archives, there's a statue that says, what is past is prologue. And so that started it. It's still going, thank heavens. Bud Park is now leading it. And it's a group, it's open to people to join. And they read a history book, and they get history books every month.
And it's theprologuesociety.com. Well, we want to thank you. It's been great to have Arva Moore Parks.
The hour's flown by.
It has. A native Miamian and noted historian, author, preservationist, longtime resident, and the author of George Merrick, Son of the South Wind, visionary creator of Coral Gables. Congratulations on the book.
I always love being here with you all.
It's a pleasure.
And thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Associate producer Polly Landis. It's easy to hear and download free audio archives from our website. That's WLRN.org. More information, photos, and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Join Bonnie and me tomorrow at an at-your-service consumer protection program. Fraud and misleading advertising are always rampant. Swindling of the elderly and such.
We forgot the Coral Gables Congregational Church. Oh, well. Next time, Marva.
Tomorrow, our guests include Miami-Dade consumer advocate Holly Beth Billington and consumer protection attorney Michael Schiff. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on NPR News.